Welcome to Ahead of the Game, a podcast brought to you by the Digital Marketing Institute. I'm your host, Will Francis, and today I'll be talking to Amrita Mathur all about how she joined Superside as their first marketer and through strong B2B marketing has helped grow that business to what it is today. Amrita is VP Marketing at Superside, a platform that offers design services for businesses and marketers by tapping into the world's top creatives. With over 15 years of experience in growth and marketing roles, Amrita has lots of insight into B2B marketing, and that's what we're going to be exploring today. Amrita, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. 15 years makes me sound so old, but yeah, I guess I've been doing this for a while.
That happens. I've noticed that with my own career and like my peers. It's like you start throwing these numbers around and it's like, yeah, we're really not young anymore. It's scary, isn't it?
It is.
Well, look, you know, I'd like to just talk about your role before we go off into the various kind of, you know, the details, get into the weeds of it. Right. So you were the first marketing person in a company before it had a product, right?
Before we had a subscription product, yeah. So our unique situation was that we were already a company with a bunch of users, but it was a ill-defined product. We didn't really know what we were selling. We were called something totally different. And it was sort of, in some ways, you could think of it as like a beta launch. Like we were just like testing and trying to see, is this a need? Who cares about this? What is the, you know, willingness to pay for this? What does that look like? So it's almost like, think of it as like a test bubble. And we had a ton of amazing data from it. And now the founder said, okay, there's something here. We need to productize this. We need to properly market it. We need to find the right buyers because perhaps these are not the right buyers. And that was the challenge when I came in on day one.
And so just to be clear, Superside today, you subscribe to it and you just get to have your banners and your email headers and your social images and whatever images you just need in the daily course of your digital marketing, you get to have them made with a certain turnaround time through that platform.
Exactly. But it's a subscription model and there's, you know, a number of different plans that you could subscribe to, which are catered to a few different use cases and buyer personas.
Got you. Right. Okay. So That's interesting to me. As a marketer, what did you think when you turned up for that job on day one? Like, what did you think your contribution was going to be?
That's a great question. I mean, I will say the expectations were certainly different than reality. And I'll also caveat by saying that this was the first time I had gone into, running marketing for a company that was extremely early stage. You could, in some ways, think about it as like pre-product, right? We didn't have product market fit or anything because we didn't really even have a product. So this was the first time I was doing both things. I was marketer number one. The product wasn't really out there and it wasn't defined who we were going after, which is not what I was used to. I was used to kind of, you know, going to companies that had had some traction and now it was about opening the doors open. It was about growth, growth at scale and all of that stuff. And here we had like kind of nothing. So that was interesting. I took the role because I wanted to do early stage. That was like a thing that I thought I would learn a lot from. And lo and behold, it's panned out. But I also really saw this as something that could just be like huge and revolutionary for like a really big part of the world. Like I knew that the market would be massive, that it would be gigantic. And it was really about shaping and figuring out who the best fit customers would be for what we could provide at the time. And I thought that would be so cool. Like, just imagine, like, you could go after, you're a B2B company, but you could go after millions and millions of different customers, which isn't normally an opportunity for all B2B companies.
No, true. And let's just go back to the, you mentioned product market fit. And I think I got a feeling not enough marketers think about this, or they've joined a company and that company's stopped thinking deeply about that, or they maybe haven't revisited it. Well, that's my theory anyway. You know, that's what I come across. There doesn't seem to be that searing clarity sometimes at a company, you know, what the need is. what the urgent problem that they're solving is. So what was your process for kind of figuring that out?
Yeah, it was a bit haphazard, but generally I'd say there was two things. One was that we knew that we could shape the go-to-market and the product at the same time. So those were two parallel tracks. Actually, someone else pointed out to me that this is often how consumer goods companies do it. Like if you're launching a new, I don't know, brand of popcorn, you know, pink popcorn, Himalayan salt popcorn, or whatever it is, you're kind of developing the product and the marketing kind of at the same time. You're trying to figure out who's the buyer, would they buy pink popcorn, you know, how much would they pay for it, can we price it more than the regular popcorn, should it have butter, should it not have butter, if it does have butter, how do we position that, right? Like all of that kind of brand marketer who's sort of like the CEO of that product line is thinking about all of those things. So this is actually not that different from that. And our process was a bit haphazard, but really it came down to two key steps. One was that we had already a bit of user data and usage data from our sort of, you know, beta testing product that was like ill-defined. So we had something, we knew something. We knew, okay, you know, we had whatever, something like 5,000 users over the lifetime of the last couple of years on and off. We knew, you know, generally what their titles were. We could bucket them into sort of these like loose personas that we had developed. We knew like who stuck around, who didn't, who came back over and over, who didn't. So we had some good hypotheses come out of that user data. And then we did our own qualitative market research, which included a ton of, again, hypotheses, and then interviewing a ton of those people that fit those personas. I think I myself did something like 52 or 55 interviews, which it doesn't seem like a lot, but you can learn so much in a short period of time. Like I think I literally went on LinkedIn and found everybody that looked like that persona that we had in our head. And I would like reach out and be like, hey, can I just get 20 minutes of your time? I want to understand your pains around design and creative. And I gave equal time to people that were like, we thought were very core personas and we saw from our user data, but also like the hypothesis ones, like the ones that we didn't see come through, but we were like, ah, there's something here. An example of that is like a content marketer. We didn't see a lot of content marketers in our usage set, but we just had a hypothesis that this is an underserved title and role, and these people have to beg, borrow, steal, and go to the creative team, go to the design org, and be like, please, can I get something that supports our blog? You know, like it's like they have this like horrible cycle. And we were like, maybe this is an underserved user. Like, so let's discover that a bit more. So yeah, anyway, did a lot of qualitative.
I mean, that's just really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I you say it's not a lot of interviews. It sounds like, I think for a small to medium sized business, that, you know, would make up a lot of our a good chunk of our listeners, I suppose. Naturally, you know, they probably don't or haven't done that to a large extent. Certainly to not that at that scale. I mean, just out of interest, how did you approach people, and why did people give you their time?
I'm not sure, but I would gather it's because it's sort of like, it's a bit of like a favor trade, you know? I had this like fancy title, like a VP of marketing is reaching out and saying, hey, I just need 20 minutes. It'd be like a huge favor. I just want to understand. And like, hey, you know what? Once this thing is out, you can get early access or whatever, right? So
there was a bit of an incentive. Like you weren't paying them or anything. You were just saying,
no,
you know, I can be, chuck you a free account, or I don't know, give you beta access, something like that. Right. I'm just interested because I think a lot of people, a lot of listeners should be thinking about how can they do that, even with a small offering, like, you know, not necessarily a software product that became as big as what you're working on.
Yeah. And you know what? Thinking of myself as a consumer and customer, like I've certainly been on all sorts of advisory boards for products that haven't launched, you know, and sometimes it's a cold outreach. Like I literally remember a guy reaching out through Product Hunt, which is where a lot of these products gets launched. And he just said, hey, you're like the perfect customer for us. We'd love for you to like advise us. Would that be cool? You'll get early access, blah, blah, blah. And like that's cool. You know, like you want to be part of something cool. You want to build momentum for something that you believe in. I already like the premise. So yeah, of course I gave him 20 minutes of my time for the next couple of weeks. You know, that wasn't that hard. So it's really about how you position the ask and sort of who you ask. In some cases, I asked friends for intros. I'd be like, hey, I saw that this person's a common connection. Can you intro me? Here's the context, right? And that worked out as well.
That's cool. I like that. What do you call that exercise? What's that called, doing that?
I just called it customer interviews. I literally was like upfront and honest. It's like, hey, we're launching this new product. You know, we think you'd be a great buyer for this. We want to understand what your world looks like. That's literally what I said.
But I mean, internally, I mean, in marketing in general, is there a name for that process, do you think? Or
yeah, but there's a new term. It's not new, I suppose. But in tech, there's a term that we call customer development, which is, I believe it was coined by Paul Graham, who founded Y Combinator. And he has a really lengthy blog post about this, which is actually pretty iconic. So it's worth looking into. You guys should Google it. But he calls it customer development because he's sort of describing the same process. It's like parallel product and go-to-market development. And it's this like process of like qualitative interviews almost. In some ways, it's very similar to what you would do to sell somebody. You know, let's say you did have a defined product and you had to go out and sell it. It's not different, not too different than that. But there's a very well-defined process. And a lot of tech companies use this, startups especially.
That's interesting. Yeah, I just looked that up actually on Paul Graham's blog. And as you say, he's the founder of Y Combinator, which is a popular incubator, one of the most successful incubators. And he said that he recently told applicants to the incubator, it's very hard to get into, it's notoriously hard to get into. The best advice I could give you for getting in is explain what you've learned from users. And he said that just last year. So yeah, you know, it's clearly there's a real focus on that in tech. But you know, in marketing, absolutely, it's about building the persona, as you called it. That's how we think about it in marketing, really getting under the skin of what their urgent problem is, what keeps them up at night, what they hate, what their pain points are, maybe with the existing product set and that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And selfish desires. I always say, like, it's not just about uncovering their pains that they tell you about that they're conscious of, but it's like the unconscious stuff too. It could be like something simple, right? It could be like, because I gave this content marketing example earlier, you could be a head of content marketing and you just want to ship stuff faster so you guys look good. It's like, wow, look how many, like we shipped 20 blog posts and 5 YouTube videos and 6 TikToks, you know, this month. Wow, that volume and the quality is so good. And all eyes are on us, right? And that's a selfish desire to look good or what have you to your peers.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's very smart as well. So was there a big launch moment that you planned for? And then what was the kind of strategy around that?
We told ourselves that we would launch the same year. So I had joined in May of 2019, and we'd kind of given ourselves a deadline of let's not push this out longer than 6 months, which is pretty tight, actually. So the main components were we have a product to sell. We would have our first few channels figured out where we'd want to test it. We would have our messaging figured out based on like the top buyer personas. And we would have our brand figured out, which meant a name for the company, potentially a name for the product. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're separate. There's good reasons and pros and cons for that. And it also meant in our case that we needed to go find like a domain, like a .com domain. This is also a Paul Graham thing where he's like, if you want to be a serious company, you need a .com. Yeah, you don't want like a .io or what have you, which, you know, people have refuted, but I get it. It's like the search value, the SEO value is unparalleled. So we started this process of like trying to define what the name of the company would be. But we only started that once we knew what the product was going to be. I think once we had the ethos of that, like, this is who we're trying to serve. This is what the product is. This is kind of what it's going to look like. Engineering had gone off and we're trying to do things in parallel. Then we took that and said, okay, let's brainstorm names for this company. And also let's find a name that we can actually get the .com for. So, you know, there was a very tiny committee of people, tiny, like literally was like founder, this lady who had joined us, who was like, I would say like a creative and branding expert. She had joined to be like the customer, to lead the customer facing side. And I was on the marketing side, but she had all that insight and knowledge. And me, it was like literally the three of us who brainstormed names all day, every day. Actually, there was one more person who's not at the company anymore. So the four of us, and we took the help of a guy who was previously credited for naming the Coca-Cola product Dasani, which Coca-Cola bought later. He had come up with Dasani, which was obviously a huge brand. He came about through an intro from one of our investors, and he joined the process later. We had already whittled it down to like a few things, but that was mighty helpful as well. And yeah, we came up with three names. We found who owned those .coms. We started negotiating with them, trying to get it. And I was personally very gung-ho about Superside. I actually didn't like the other options on the table personally, but yeah, we were, after a lot of haggling, we were able to buy Superside.com from this like really sweet German couple that used to use the domain for a sidecar racing competition, which was hilarious. You should actually look that up on YouTube. Hilarious. It's like the scooters with the sidecar attached to them and they're racing each other. It was crazy. So we bought it from them, and then the rest was history. Like, we like took that domain, came up with a very small like little website, you know, like 5 or 6 pages is all we had.
Nice and lean on that side. And then, was there marketing around it at that launch point? You know, did you plan kind of like, you know, a channel strategy, and you do have line items of all your different kinds of marketing? You don't have to talk us through it. I'm just interested, was there quite a broad spray?
No, so we didn't do a broad spray. So our strategy was, we have this test and learn methodology, right? And we wanted to like quickly understand, is our hypothesis correct? Can we attract these customers? At what scale and velocity can we attract these customers? What is the willingness to pay, et cetera, right? So we wanted to learn that quickly. So we were like, okay, how do you get in customers really, really fast so we could learn? It's okay if they don't buy, but we wanted to learn. So our CEO, Frederick, talks a lot about this. He was like, optimize for velocity of learning, not velocity of like revenue. He was like, let's not worry about the revenue part, but like get to the learnings and the insights very quickly. So, yeah, that was quite, like, it was only like 4 years ago, but revolutionary. Even when I heard it, I was like, damn, this is like a guy I want to work for, you know?
That's very cool. I mean, because, you know, I was stalking you on LinkedIn, as I do with my guests, and I was looking at some of the stuff, you know, you talk about there, and you give some great advice, actually. One of the things you say, you warn other software as a service companies not to boast that we don't do marketing. And that's absolutely, I know what you mean. I've seen that boast a lot, like, we grew to like so much, you know, recurring revenue, so many users without doing any marketing. But it's like a badge of honor, isn't it? And it's implying that the product was just so bloody good that it didn't require any marketing. So why is that? Why do you warn people quite vocally against that?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's probably a bit untrue when people say that. It is possible that you get to some level of virality just through product users and product people, like the people using the product tell their friends or whatever, and then they end up using it. So I guess that's possible, and that's not quote unquote traditional marketing, but it's still marketing because you've built virality inside the product and you've built word of mouth inside the product. And it's usually someone in marketing or growth thinking about that and building that in. So that is a form of marketing.
Right. So it's about the definition of marketing. What they often mean is, we didn't have millions of dollars to spend on like big ad campaigns.
Exactly. So they're talking maybe about advertising potentially.
So they did do marketing, but it's usually more kind of, yeah, like say word of mouth driven and social product hunt platforms, communities, etc.
Exactly. So it's often not true, but even regardless of the truth, it's sort of like, I feel like marketing lifts so many different boats. You know, it's like it can help with recruiting amazing talent. It can help with fundraising. It can help create this like halo effect. It can help shape the product narrative, right? Like you might be a product that's like quite innovative, but in a very saturated competitive space. So it can help you differentiate and shape that. I see marketing as both like a long-term and short-term bet. Like it actually has two different modes. And when you don't invest in marketing, you're actually saying like, I'm not investing in the long-term. It might be okay for the short-term, but you're not investing in the long-term.
That's true, isn't it? I mean, I suppose it's a lovely idea. I mean, Jeff Bezos very famously said, I think it was about 10, 15 years ago, advertising is the price you pay for having an unremarkable product or service. Now, obviously, advertising is different than marketing. That is paid. We're talking about buying, you know, high cost media. And there is a grain of truth to that, of course, but it's an accelerant. It's a catalyst, isn't it? It's like putting, you know, gasoline on the barbecue because you need to get the food served kind of thing.
It's a timing thing. It's like you're trying to capture revenue when the barbecue is hot, you know, or you know, it's sort of like, why do companies invest in Super Bowl ads? It's not just the fact that millions of people are going to see it. It's sort of for them that it's got other curves. You know, it's got perhaps they're about to do a massive fundraise, and that ad actually accelerates that and gets visibility and, like, you know, it clarifies what the product positioning is. Perhaps it's a way to get eyeballs on just like literally like getting signups, and like there's like you're taking friction away from the user journey. There's so many good reasons for why people would do that. And yeah, a Super Bowl ad or whatever big campaign could be seen as like throwing money at the problem. And I'm sure many people have made mistakes of like not really fully thinking it out. But it doesn't mean that you have an unremarkable product. It just means you've hopefully the marketing team, whoever does that, has thought about, I'm going to deploy this spend. Like, I think it on average costs $7 million to do a Super Bowl ad, for example. I'm just using that as an example here, an anchor. And you've said, I know if I spend this seven, I know I can turn this into whatever, right? That the ratio that you're comfortable with. I can turn this into 10 million this year, which is something I need to hit my revenue targets or what have you. So it's actually very efficient spend because that ratio works for us. We think about payback period at Supersite. Like, we don't really think about spend versus what I'm getting back alone, that equation. We think about how long does it take for us to recoup the money that we've spent, which includes marketing salaries, sales salaries, all our marketing budget, and the small sales budget, which they don't have a huge budget. But if you combine all of that, how long does it take me to recoup what I've spent? And historically, up until the middle of last year, it used to be 6 months, which is remarkable. Industry standard for high growth companies is actually like around 12 months. That's what they say is great. Like, in a year, if you can recoup all the money, you're a good place. So for us, it's ballooned up to 10 months now. But yeah, historically, 6 months. And that is a great metric to know if you're efficient. It's essentially like a capital deployment metric.
Yeah, no, that's really good. That's a really good way to look at it, actually. And it kind of makes more sense because the timelines don't really add up. If you say, well, we spent so much on marketing this month, where are those dollars actually going? How can we say whether the sales this month or next month were because of this month's marketing? And oh God, it becomes, you know, a big knotted ball you try and unpick. Hello, a quick reminder from me that if you're enjoying our podcast series, why not become a member of the DMI so that you can enjoy loads more content from webinars and case studies to toolkits and more real-life insights from the world of digital marketing. Head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com/aheadofthegame to sign up for free. Now back to the podcast. Okay, that's interesting. I mean, just putting you on the spot a bit, but let's say I'm just about to... maybe I've created a marketing tool, like maybe some sort of like SEO tool or something, right? Quite simple. And I'm about to stick it on Product Hunt. and launch it in a very, very basic way. Would you have any kind of obvious advice? Well, that's obvious to you, of like key things to do, maybe quite grassroots, quite low cost, you know, scrappy, hacky things to do to start to build an audience around that, starting from zero?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess it depends so much on the product and the space that you're in. Sometimes you can piggyback on an existing trend or product. So, you know, there's tons of companies that have been built that are just like tacked on to something else. Like a great, my favorite example of this company is this company called Zapier, which, and it's all they do is that they found a way to plug, like literally plug two tech systems together. It, so it could be your HubSpot marketing automation and your Salesforce CRM, or it could be something smaller. It could be your video editing tool in Wistia with your website CMS tool that houses all your content or whatever, right? Like it's like a plug and play kind of thing. It just makes the APIs of these products talk to each other. That is amazing because now you can piggyback on the marketing, the quote unquote marketing of all of these tools out there. You can say anyone searching for HubSpot CRM, I'm just using search as an example, Zapier can show up on that same list and be like, oh, when you buy HubSpot CRM, use Zapier to connect, blah, 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 right?
They do that very well with their content marketing as well. They create a lot of content about best CRM tools. They've definitely got an article on that, you know, or anytime you search for stuff, a lot of their content comes up and you end up on their site and you're like, oh, hang on a minute. Not only am I learning about this, but when I've chosen a CRM tool, I know to come back here to connect it to my Stripe payments or something, you know.
Exactly. They've wedged themselves into the user or the buyer's mind well before the buying decision has even happened, right? So that's wonderful. That's beautiful. This is what I mean by piggybacking on something, right? Could be a trend, could be a tool, could be another wave that's happening. There's other examples. An old school one is there used to be this product called, I think they were called Reportive, and then they got bought by Google, where you could open up your email, and if you just added the Reportive plugin or Chrome extension, you could see the profile of the person you were conversing with, which was like a whole thing back then. Just on the side, like their photo, where they worked, any social media that use that same email address would like be pulled up. So you knew like who you were actually chatting with. And that was like a very helpful tool back in the day. Now it's maybe like less helpful, but Google folded that into their suite, which was nice. And it was like a tiny little lightweight little product, but it went wild because there was just like no visibility on who was emailing you and who the hell this person is and are they legit or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's a very good. So like, yeah, if I built something and found a way to like build ChatGPT or rather GPT-3 into it, right? Jumping on a current very hot topic, something a lot of people are searching, something that naturally gets eyeballs in product type forums and what have you.
Yeah. So I think a lot of it depends on the product and the space that you're in, but there's many ways. And my general advice is like, try not to go down too many rabbit holes in the beginning, like pick a path or two, you know?
What do you think to growing in the open? This whole trend of growing in the open where, you know, startups are basically just publishing everything that they're doing and how it's working and just literally publishing their analytics, their sales figures. I follow quite a few companies who do that just out of sheer fascination, you know. But there does seem to be something there because you get a community who actually to some extent care about what you're doing and are just more engaged, even if they're not. Like I follow companies I'll never use, but I'm just fascinated, but I am more likely to recommend them because I know about them, and they'd be the first tool of that kind that came to mind, right?
Yeah, the build in public thing is definitely, I will say, like in some ways, it's kind of been, sort of excuse my French, but like bastardized a little bit. Like what it used to be and what it is now is not quite the same. But generally,
tell me more.
Well, I think what you just described, the community building aspect of that, is solid. That is exactly right. I think that's the whole reason behind it. And it was also like a great way for technical founders who often came from engineering backgrounds to kind of like learn from the market, right? It's actually customer development, but cloaked a little bit. So it was great for technical founders and in particular to like actually be talking to potential users and customers and getting insight and feedback. Great way to build a Twitter following and whatever else. But now it's been, warped to the point where like it's kind of become marketing, and it's like, what are you even marketing? Like how cool you are? Like, are you marketing? Like you don't even have a product. You have nothing right now and you're, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just taken on this like life that
I know what you mean. If you were to, like today, if you were to parody the gestation process of a startup, someone in the meeting would go, guys, we got to do grow in public. We got to do grow in public without really even knowing what it means. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, put it on the whiteboard, you know.
No, I think there's value there. I don't know if it's for every product. I think that there's the caution is that there are sometimes situations where you do want to be a lot more ready before you launch in prime time because it might be a very, very competitive product. And maybe you don't want your trade secrets and your differentiation stolen, right? Because like you want that first mover advantage. So I think there's some situations where you don't want to do that. But yeah, great, great point actually to bring that up.
Yeah, no, it fascinates me. Definitely does. Okay, so just to probe you about your kind of manifesto, I suppose, and the things that you think that you've talked about online. Como is a term that you've talked and perhaps even coined. What do you mean, and how can we apply that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was just, I think I was just riffing one day. I was trying to explain something to our marketing team, and Como is sort of like FOMO. You know, you have fear of missing out, and Como is the cost of missing out. It is a way of thinking about your marketing or your go-to-market set and thinking about, is this a worthwhile endeavor? Perhaps it's a very expensive or complicated endeavor. Just a simple framework to think about, is it worth doing it or not, is to think about what is the cost of missing out on this thing.
So you mean really that by not doing certain things, that actually presents potentially massive cost to the business?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I will caveat by saying that maybe it's a boom time framework that, you know, like maybe it's not helpful when times are tough, which 2023 is kind of shaping up to be like that. But I think when there's like access to capital, and when you have access to, or not access, but like you have a generally like higher risks taking attitude, if the company can take a lot more risk, it's really thinking about, like you said, the opportunity cost of not doing something. So it's just a way to shift your mind to like not saying, you know, like a typical decision making process is, how hard is it to do this? How long is it going to take? What is it going to cost? Oh my God, all of these things are like very high, so maybe we're not going to do it. It's a way to shift away from that and really think about, what is the opportunity cost that you're giving up? What is the cost of you not doing it? Is some other person in your sphere, a competitor perhaps, going to do something similar and like take that chance and take that one spot that's available to do that?
It's true. It's just another way of coming at the decision, isn't it, really? Kind of a more of a why not.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, rather than a why should we do this?
Yeah.
Mm. Something else actually you've said, just to get more shift away from your work at Superside to your career a bit, if you don't mind, we've got about 10 minutes left. You've said in the past that you manage your energy and not your time. I feel like I probably really like that idea, but I'd love to hear more about it. Sounds interesting.
I think that in some ways we kind of haven't given up our factory ways, you know, like we're all like these like line, what's the word? I'm blanking on it, but we're kind of just like at a car factory just standing in a line.
Operatives.
Yeah, operatives. You know, sometimes we treat our own selves like that, right? You're like, I got to go to work every day. I start my meetings at 8 o'clock and I'm going to be done at 6 or whatever the hell it is. And I think that the typical knowledge worker is not getting the most out of their own self by working like that. There are days, such as today, where my brain isn't turned on in the morning. I'm not a morning person. I know that about myself. I don't like doing my higher order thinking in the morning. So I actually take a lot of meetings in the morning, do a lot of mundane whatever stuff. And then my brain turns on, like the real true creative thinking where I'm like coming up with original stuff, actually for me happens later at night, typically after dinner and after my daughter goes to bed. So I know that about myself and I tap into that every single day. I make space for that every single day. There's no specific amount of time. I don't go sit at my desk or what have you. I could be anywhere in the house. But I know like, okay, between 10 and 11, this is the type of like work that I want to do. If I'm writing like a piece from scratch, or if I'm trying to like work on this, like maybe prepping for this podcast, right? I do those kinds of things at that time. And I also don't hold myself to this like standard of like work 8-10 hours a day or what have you. Some days I work 6 hours a day, some days I work 14 hours a day. And that's okay. It's not for everyone, but I think if you understand your own circadian rhythms and how you tend to operate and which days are good for you and which days aren't going to be good for you, you can actually build a lot of productivity around that. So that's really what I mean by energy, you know, like kind of don't block yourself into these like slots that the company or your colleagues might have defined.
Yeah, it's very true that working hours are a really questionable idea these days because, you know, Superside employ you and they've basically bought an exclusive access to you as a VP of marketing, haven't they? That's what you buy. And I think about in Europe, you know, think about football. The way they do it makes more sense. It's like, you know, Lionel Messi plays for Paris Saint-Germain and he doesn't have to, I mean, I'm sure there are training, there are things he has to turn up for, but they've just bought, the reason they pay all that money is he's their player. And that he's the only team in the world that he plays for. And that is worth the money. And it either is or it isn't. And I think it's a bit more like that, isn't it? And like you say, it's then up to you to deliver. Obviously, if you're in your in your annual review, it's like, yeah, so you basically took a year long vacation and been paid for it. Obviously, you're going to lose your job. And we all know that. And who would even do that, you know, and who would take that liberty? You want to excel and move forward in your career. So the idea of this 9-to-5 all is a site when you in light of that is seems completely irrelevant.
To me, it is. And I think like, I'm big on rituals that the team does together, you know, but those are like predefined. Like maybe it's like we do this like big end of month marketing meeting, right? We want the whole team. Our team is a 60 person team. We want every single person in that meeting, asking questions, paying attention, doing shout outs, you know, acknowledging each other's achievements, et cetera, right? That's a ritual that we've defined. We've picked a time that works for everybody in all the different time zones, et cetera. So other than those rituals, I generally think people should be able to do whatever they want, whenever they want, as long as you're delivering results and getting the work done, who cares? You can sit on a beach, you can do it at 10 o'clock at night, doesn't matter.
It's very true, isn't it? I mean, look, even in the old days, when did you ever sit in your annual performance review at work and were asked how many hours you've worked this year? I mean, no one ever has ever asked that anyway, it's, like you say, since the Victorian age, so... Yeah, it does seem a bit funny, doesn't it? So just and so you manage your energy basically by shaping your day to capture your best self when you need your best self. So funny, I'm the total opposite to you. I have meetings like this. This is my afternoon because after lunch I sort of like lose it a bit. And yeah, I do a very similar thing to what you've described, funnily enough, because trying to work through your slump part of the day to me is like nails down the blackboard level tedium. It's horrific.
Yeah. Why? Why do that? That's the time you should go for a walk or take a nap or whatever, right? Like why go through that? That's just anxiety causing for no reason. There's sleep types or something. There's like animals assigned to different sleep patterns.
Chronotypes.
Chronotypes. That's what it is. Sleep chronotypes. Exactly.
Different chronotypes. We have different patterns through the day, a different rhythm. Right. That's interesting. Do you know what? I think there's something that needs to be said as well is you've become okay with that and you don't try and pretend that you're anything else. And I think a lot of people are still stuck in that, like, we have this inherent guilt about, like, oh, I must move the mouse so Slack makes it look like I'm online and, you know, because I'm working from home. And a lot of people have this, like, working from home guilt of, like, I must look like I'm clocking in the hours. And actually, people should be just more upfront and say, look, if you want me to work for you, this is how I work. This is when I'm productive. You'll get me here. You probably won't be able to reach me at this point in the day. And if that's okay, great. And if it's not, great, you know, whatever. And I think we just, it's about being comfortable with it in yourself and then being comfortable to be open with that, you know, and so everyone else is okay with it.
I mean, every company has a different DNA. So you want to tap into that and you want to be respectful to that. But, you know, I also just in parallel to that believe in some, like, you know, severe level of transparency. So for example, on Mondays, I take a yoga class that starts at 5:30. So I got to leave the house at 5 o'clock or whatever. And I mark that in my calendar. So basically people know I'm not going to be reachable after 5 o'clock, but I will respond to you. They know my patterns, right? I'll respond to you at like 9 o'clock my time or whatever. But I don't do that class every single day. I only do that on Mondays. And there's another guy on our team who absolutely has to go to the gym in his building during the day. So he has blocked off like 11 to 12 almost every single day, right? So he's unavailable. We don't book meetings at that time. So it's this level of transparency that allows us to all work together. And, you know, I think that if of course, employers can be flexible, but also it's the onus is on the employee to communicate that to their peers and to their teams and say, hey, I'm going to be gone, or hey, you can book any time in my meeting calendar, but these times are blocked off or whatever. But find ways to properly, respectfully communicate that.
Yeah, it's very true. I think it's good. That'd be great if everyone, all teams worked in that way. I think a lot less anxiety, stress, guilt, and etc. In the time we've got left, I'd love to hear a bit about your journey from growing up and studying in India and then starting your career in Canada. Would you mind just kind of telling us how that's gone? Because a lot of our listeners are in both North America and India and Asia in general in that part of the world, and think about these kind of like major, you know, transitions in life quite a lot. So how did that happen for you?
Yeah, some of it was like a little bit accidental and perhaps not as intentional as it might look on, you know, someone's resume or what have you. But for me, it was, you know, I did computer science in school. I was like working as a developer, hated it. I think like 20 years ago, it just wasn't the same. Like there was no pair programming. Like you were kind of like off on your own. And like we didn't have like Ruby on Rails and React. Like we had like Java and C++. Like it was awful. It was anyway mind numbing. Didn't love that. And I just decided like that I just can't be doing this my whole life. So I already knew I wanted to transition to business. The only job I'd really had while I was in India, I'd finished university there, was this like co-op job. And I just, in that co-op, I just was friendly with a bunch of people and just like shadowed like as much as possible other functions, other business functions. And then fortunately, in my case, my parents had applied for immigration to Canada and that came through at the same time. And they said, hey, you should just go check it out. You know, maybe you can take a course or a program. In India, everybody that wants to progress in their career because it's such intense competition does take like a master's program or something. So that's like a given, like you just have to do that. So my parents were like, go to Canada and do your master's there. And I was like, okay, but I didn't really get into anything because they told me in the summer and the school year would start in September. So, you know, I ended up applying to like a college, like a well-respected college, but nothing crazy. Came here, did a one-year program, very much bent on business and marketing. And then was like, oh, that there's something here. I like it. And my first job that I got was at a tech company, you know, very entry level position, but it was in marketing. And I use that as my own test and learn loop, right? I wanted to know, is this cool? Will I like it? Can I be good at it? can I marry that with some of the education I've had? And the fact that it was at a tech company and we were selling a very technical product was kind of nice, but yet I was getting the marketing experience. And after that first job, I was like, yep, this is it. Like I knew. And I was, my manager said like, wow, you're really good at data. You're good at analytics. You're good at like thinking outside the box. Like all of the things that she told me, I took to heart and said, okay, wow, I'm going to get better at this. I'm going to learn more about this by doing, by listening to other people. I found like a few mentors in the company. And the rest is history. But it sounds like smooth sailing, but I think there was a lot of doubt along the way. But the one thing I was very clear on is that I do not want to be in a dead end job, and I do not want to be in a profession that I don't like. I had way too many family members who were just like doing these jobs and they just hated it. And like, I did not want to be like them. So I was hell bent on finding whatever that combination was. For me, fortunately, like that first thing hit and worked. But it could have very well been something like that didn't work out.
Yeah, true. It's very true that in hindsight, all careers look very linear, even ones that bounce around a bit, they look planned. And, you know, but at the time, at any point in time, if you'd have asked that version of Amrita back then, you'd be like, no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea where it's going. And that's kind of the same with almost everyone, I think, unless you're in very specific, you know, professions like maybe law or medicine. Okay, right. And what did you learn? What surprising things did you learn on that journey?
Like in the early days?
Yeah, just and in that and specifically in making that transition from India to Canada and then starting out in marketing. I suppose those are the two key kind of inflection points that are interesting to me.
I can say this because I'm from India, and hopefully no one takes offense to this, but I think that some cultures, we have this like almost like deity style reverence for our bosses. And in India, and perhaps in Britain, we refer to them as sir or madam. But in Canada, in North America, it's not like that. Everyone is Bob, right? You call them by their first name. That was very refreshing for me. It actually gives you so much power because you realize I'm not here to do what they're telling me to do. They're not even telling me to do something. I need to figure that out for myself.
I didn't know that. So that's actually very interesting as a cultural difference. So yeah, you feel like when you went to Canada, you were just told what the goal is, and then it's up to you how to achieve it. There's that extra bit of initiative and autonomy.
Well, some of the how. Yeah, there was some of the how, because I was very junior. Obviously, I was an entry-level position. So there was a little bit of the hand-holding, right, the happening. But no one was standing over my desk telling me exactly what to do and how to do it and what have you. In fact, they involved me in some pretty big decisions. Like we, at the time, marketing automation was new and we were looking at some systems. It was like a new thing altogether. And there was like very few companies that offered it. And I was in the meetings on all the evaluations of this technology, which was so empowering. So the realization really there was, I'm here to help my boss look good. I'm here to help our team hit our goals. I am here to add value in any which way I think I can. I don't need permission and I don't need to be told, hey, focus here. I can be like, hey, I volunteer. I want to do this. Can I be in this meeting or can I do this? Or, hey, I had this idea. Should we try it? You know, I think that approach was helpful. And it also was just culturally for me, it was like really refreshing to see my bosses and my peers and everybody kind of like the almost like the hierarchy was like collapsed. You know, everyone, there was a hierarchy, obviously. And, you know, there were some very smart people that got paid a lot more than me. But I almost saw it as like, they're here as mentors to help the process and to help me, and not as my, this like God, you know, which is like, maybe sometimes, I don't know. And I think in India, it's like a slightly different philosophy.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And then in terms of encountering marketing, you weren't sure whether that was going to be the thing that you loved. What about it grabbed you? What about it did you think, yeah, this is for me?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it was a bit of a fluke, but what I had caught on to was, even in school, like I kind of grabbed onto the fact that marketing was going through a big shift where it was extremely tech and data driven. I think literally until the early 2000s, it was very much this, not like a full Don Draper situation or Mad Men situation, but sort of like a lot of opinions, very opinion driven. And I think that that was changing in the early 2000s. And that was very clear with all the tech that was available to marketing, and things that were considered more mass marketing were now available to like even the smaller companies, such as through tools like automation and some really like fancy analytic tools and data lakes that you could now actually like just run SQL queries on and be like, oh, this is what's happening with all our users, right? And learn from that very quickly. So I think that all of that was happening at the same time. And I don't know if I thought about it quite with this level of clarity, but I was like, oh, it's cool. There's tech in marketing. I can use tech. I'm good at tools. Like it was kind of like that train of thinking. And it kind of like transpired and like worked out in a way that I was able to leverage that.
Yeah, that's interesting coming from that technical background, because a lot of people come at it, creatively and predominantly, I think, perhaps. What are your top three tips for someone who's about to launch a software product?
Yes. So we've kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'll just say the first thing is have a solid hypothesis for who your best fit personas or buyer personas are going to be, and test and learn really fast. You know, give yourself a like time box it as much as possible, right? Like we time boxed it and said 6 months. Six months, we need to know what the hell we're doing. And it's possible to, it's important to remember that it's possible that the person that buys your product is different than the person that uses your product. So keep your eye on that as well. It's almost like two different parallel tracks, particularly if you're in B2B, like often the buyer is different than the user. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing, which everyone seems to like gloss over, and I don't understand this, is like, ensure that you mimic the language that your buyers use on your website copy, like really wherever the conversion happens, whatever the entry point is for people and wherever the conversion happens, try to mimic that language. There's a way that people talk. Like, let's say your product is a fintech product and you're in the financial services industry, and there's like a very specific way that people might talk about that. That could be established. It could be very jargony. You need to understand that world and mimic that, just so that people will understand you a lot better and convert a lot faster. And I'd say the third thing is do not forget about pricing. B2C companies understand this really well, less so in B2B, but it's like an important lever. So use that lever for long-term revenue growth, and really think about not just bringing people in the door, but finding people that stick around. It's that long-term revenue that you're looking for, good revenue, as our CEO would call it. He's like, we don't want any customer. We want good customers. What does good look like for your company? Figure that out fast.
I like that. That's very interesting. Yeah, it's not all about the sale today. It's the lifetime value. It's about getting customers that are going to really get value out of what we do, stick around and remain loyal and become and tell other people about it, of course. Yeah, that's good. And I love your second point as well. I run courses about marketing all the time, and I'm always telling people, like, it was about 50 years ago that David Ogilvy, one of the like godfathers of copywriting, said, just talk to your customer in your copy as you would say it to them. Don't be like all hyperbole, you know, like the world's leading, Canada's premier solution for, you know, it's that's not how people talk in any industry. But you're right. Then go deep into the jargon. How would these people say these things and talk about these things? And it will resonate that bit more closely and convert. Love that. Right. They're great tips. Thanks so much. And I feel like I've learned a lot in that hour. Thank you. Really appreciate it, Amrita. I just have one more question for you. Just remind listeners where they can find and connect with you online.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn. You can find me at Amrita Mather, very easily Googleable. Is that a word? I don't think so. But yeah, very good, very Googleable. And then, I'm pretty active on both. And then, of course, If you're listening and your company needs design, you can find us at superside.com.
Absolutely. And is that design of any kind of assets? What kind of assets could that be?
Yeah, pretty much. It's like a pretty full stack, breadth of capabilities. It could be like long form video, it could be short form video for social, creator led. So it could be for a channel that you're trying to like crack into. So it could be like, oh my God, we really want to explode on Instagram Reels or TikTok or what have you. And then of course, like huge use case around advertising creative, because really like the final frontier on eking out performance from your Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn campaign is through great creative. So you need like a lot of creative to test very, very quickly. And so Superside fits nicely into that use case.
Great. Well, we'll all be going checking that out and yourself on LinkedIn and Twitter. Amrita, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Will.
Thanks. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about transforming your marketing career through certified online training, head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com. Thanks for listening.